Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Through the centuries, artists have adopted a variety of approaches to pastel, experimenting with it to achieve exciting and unexpected effects. Featuring approximately 70 exquisite examples drawn entirely from the permanent collection, The Touch of Color, Pastels at the National Gallery of Art, traces the history of pastel from the Renaissance to the 21st century and examines the many techniques that artists have developed to work with this colorful and versatile medium. To celebrate the opening on September 29, 2019, Kimberly Schenck and Stacy Sell provide an overview of the works, many of which have never been exhibited before. The exhibition is on view at the National Gallery of Art through January 26, 2020.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming. I'm Stacy Sell, one of the exhibition's two curators. I'd like to start out by talking about what pastel is and why we decided to do an exhibition tracing its history. The medium itself has changed very little since its origins in the 15th century. As in their earliest days, pastels still consist of a carefully balanced mixture of pigment, white opaque filler, such as chalk or clay, and a binder, such as gum, mixed into a paste and then shaped into sticks and dried. An artist working with pastel applies both color and line at one stroke, giving the medium a special spontaneity. Pastel's most remarkable quality, its crumbly texture, is the key to its beauty, as these colored lines can be left intact or blended into soft areas of velvety tone. This unique texture is also the source of incredible adaptability. Pastel can be applied wet or dry by drawing with a stick or by grinding it to a powder and painting it on with a brush. Pastel is so versatile, in fact, that some pastelists have considered their finished works drawings, while others have thought of them as paintings. This same crumbly texture, however, is a vulnerability as well as an asset. Pastel dust doesn't adhere securely to the paper or other support, leaving finished pastels susceptible not only to accidental smearing, but even to excessive movement, which can shake the powder loose. As a result, many pastels are so fragile that they can't travel as exhibition loans. The gallery is lucky to have a broad enough collection of pastels that we can mount an exhibition tracing the entire history of the medium, all from our permanent collection. The gallery's been acquiring pastels since 1939, even before opening to the public. More recently, the selection was greatly enhanced by the arrival of works by artists such as Degas and Millet from the Corcoran Gallery. Works on paper can't be exposed to the light for long periods, however, and many of these beautiful works have not been exhibited in decades, if at all. We're delighted to have this opportunity to show them to you. One last bit of background before I begin. I worked on this exhibition with Kimberly Schenck, our head of paper conservation. This collaboration was crucial not only because the objects themselves require special handling, and a few of them needed conservation work before they could be displayed, but even more importantly, because Kim has examined every one of the objects, often under special lighting or magnification. Her research has revealed new information about many of the works in the exhibition, offering tantalizing glimpses into the many ways artists used pastel. For the first half of the program today, I'll be giving you an overview of the history of pastel. Kim will follow with a closer look at some of the works she's examined. The exhibition opens with a selection of drawings in colored chalk. Pastel's origins are closely linked with the use of chalk, a naturally occurring substance excavated from the earth in a limited range of colors. Federico Barocci, working in the mid-16th century, was among the earliest to use both pastel and colored chalk regularly in his preliminary studies for paintings. The sketch on the left is a study for a figure in an altarpiece. Artists also increasingly used colored chalk and pastel for finished portraits or head studies intended as independent works of art, like the Luti on the right. By the early 18th century, however, the latter use had won out. This was the era of pastel painting. Artists usually worked on paper mounted on canvas, imitating the effects of oil painting by covering this surface with an opaque, carefully blended layer of pastel. Pastels from this period in particular appeal to our sense of touch in a way that most drawings don't. We want to reach out and run our fingers across the velvety surfaces, but please don't, because that would be bad. Among the most influential of the pastel painters was Rosalba Carriera, whose varied touch and delicate colors made her a true pastel celebrity. She left her native Venice for a visit to Paris in 1720, and her popularity cemented the appeal of pastel painting for the rest of the century. Her fame spread throughout Europe as she traveled and welcomed tourists from around the world to her studio at home in Venice. Rosalba's visit to Paris led to a wave of enthusiasm for pastel painting among the French, leading one Parisian curmudgeon to complain in 1747, "Pastel has become excessively fashionable. Everyone has a colored crayon in his hand." The mid-18th century in France was a period of astonishing technical brilliance. Artists like Maurice Quentin de la Tour took full advantage of pastel's rich colors and its ability to mimic the textures of sumptuous fabric and the warmth of human flesh. Latour was renowned not only for his skill in depicting his sitters' costumes and surroundings, but also for his unerring ability to capture their fleeting expressions and gestures. This apparent spontaneity was the result of careful study, as he made multiple quick preparatory sketches while he engaged his subjects in conversation. One of the pleasures of pastel from this period is examining them closely to see how artists achieved these spectacular effects. This beautifully observed row of tacks, composed of dense dabs of color, is one of my favorite things in the whole exhibition. It's rivaled by this virtuoso depiction of a scarf in this portrait by Perronneau, the masterful shift between white lines on a dark background and brown lines on white create the illusion of a carelessly wadded piece of lace. As pastel's popularity grew, other women followed Rosalba's lead and took up the medium. Adelaide Labille-Guyard was one of only four women, two of them pastelists, admitted to the French Royal Academy. At a time when opportunities were exceptionally limited for women artists, pastel was considered clean and appropriately ladylike, or, as one 18th century writer put it, far preferable to their soiling their fair hands with painting in colors and oil. Pastel was also regarded as simpler to master than oil paint. The association of women with pastel extended beyond the realm of the artist herself. Many saw the medium's fragility as a metaphor for the fleeting nature of feminine beauty. The word fleur, or bloom, was used to describe both flawless female complexions and the velvety texture of pastels, as we see in a dreary popular song of the mid-18th century called "To Flavella, Occasioned by Her Picture in Crayons, Sent as a Present, but Damaged by Carriage," which includes the lines, "Hence learn, ye self-confiding fair, on what slight thread your bloom depends. One blast, one breath of puffing air, at once the cloud-built vision ends." Although the link between women and pastel diminished over the centuries, you'll see works by several other women, including Mary Cassatt and Käthe Kollwitz, throughout the exhibition. The craze for pastel reached Britain as travelers to France and Italy brought home pastels as souvenirs. We have two examples in the exhibition: This Young Man by Rosalba, in Venice on his grand tour, and this more elaborate portrait by Hugh Douglas Hamilton, an Irish artist whose studio in Rome catered to this clientele. At this point in his career, Hamilton specialized in these spectacular full-length images showing well-dressed aristocrats lounging on monuments and contemplating the grandeur that was Rome. In some, including ours, the pose is even derived from classical sculpture, which Hamilton studied and admired. Hamilton made the face on a separate sheet of paper and meticulously attached it to the body. This would have minimized the amount of time the subject had to spend sitting for the portrait. Once the likeness of his face was taken, he was free to return to his vacation while the artist completed the body from a studio assistant or even a clothed mannequin. Pastel was a practical choice for portraitists, not only for elaborate works like the Hamilton, but also for more modest ones, like this example by John Russell. As a dry medium, pastel was faster and more portable than oil paint, meaning that fewer sittings were required, and the artist could easily travel to the client. In fact, one portraitist recorded that he could finish 30 to 40 pastels in a year, nearly twice the number of oil paintings that he could complete in that time. The simpler portraits made by Russell and his contemporaries were within the reach of the upper middle class. Many of the customers for these less formal, more intimate portraits were women. Inventories record that small pastels were commonly found in women's dressing rooms and private apartments, while prints were more likely to decorate the equivalent male spaces. Russell also wrote a manual for the growing number of amateur pastelists, many of them women, anxious to learn this appropriately ladylike accomplishment. Pastel had fallen out of favor by the early 19th century. With the French Revolution and the rise of neoclassicism, pastel portraits of aristocrats began to look outdated and frivolous. Medium was increasingly regarded as a pastime for amateurs. Pastel never fell completely out of use, however. Its portability and immediacy, for example, made it the perfect medium for artists working outdoors, like Paul Huet. With a few strokes of brilliant color, the artist recorded the effects of a sunset so vividly that 150 years later, we're still tempted to shade our eyes when we look into the sun. The true revival of interest in pastel, however, came later in the century, with the work of Millet. In contrast to the pastel painters of the previous century, Millet thought of his pastels as drawings. While his pastoral scenes may not appear radical to modern eyes, they were a revelation to 19th century audiences. Millet rejected the painterly blending of his predecessors, leaving many of the lines of his energetic hatching and contours intact with the bare paper peeking through. His work contributed to an international revival of interest in pastel and served as an inspiration to the Impressionists. Pastel's immediacy aligned perfectly with the Impressionists' goals. Monet, for instance, appreciated its speed, spontaneity, and portability, all of which appealed to his desire to capture fleeting effects of light and weather. He turned to pastel sporadically throughout his career. This example dates from late in his life. On a visit to London to study the effects of winter fog on the Thames, Monet was briefly stymied when his painting equipment was held up in customs. He made a series of pastels from his hotel window while he waited for his paints to arrive, writing in a letter to his wife that he was out of practice with the medium after a long hiatus. He said, "This amuses me a lot, even though I'm no longer accustomed to it. It occupies me and it may be useful." When he was finally reunited with his paints, he felt that his exercises in pastel inspired new approach in his paintings. Pastel attracted the Impressionists for other reasons as well. In some ways, it was the perfect medium of the avant-garde, as its color and spontaneity presented a bold departure from the dark, highly finished oil paintings of academic art. Of all the Impressionists, Degas was the most ceaselessly creative pastelist. The gallery is particularly fortunate to have an excellent collection of Degas pastels. In addition to the ones you'll see in this exhibition, several more are in Paris right now at the Degas and the Opera exhibition, which opens here next March, so I hope you'll come back and see them then. Degas reworked prints with pastel, applied the medium both wet and dry, and sprayed areas with fixatives so that he could rework passages without smearing the colors beneath. Pastel's intense colors also lent themselves to experimentation with contemporary color theory. Here, Degas juxtaposes complementary colors, turquoise and orange on the left, and yellow and blue-violet on the right, exploring the idea that colors appear brighter when placed next to their opposites. Like his 18th century predecessors, he reveled in pastel's powdery, velvety texture. However, he did not share their interest in using it to describe the appearance of the world around him. Instead, the distinct marks and patches of fluffy pastel draw our attention to the process and materials of creating art. While the pastels of this period present a striking contrast with those of the previous century, the revival of interest in the medium also sprang in part from a renewed appreciation for 18th century art. Degas and Mary Cassatt both admired the work of Latour, for example, and made multiple visits to the recently opened museum exhibiting Latour's pastels in Saint-Quentin, his hometown. In Paris, several exhibitions featuring 18th century pastel paintings may have influenced Manet's decision to take up the medium near the end of his life. He almost certainly chose pastel for practical reasons as well. His health was failing, and he found it physically less challenging than oil paint. A friend noted, "Pastel was for him a comparatively easy exercise, a diversion, and gained him the company of the engaging women who came to pose for him." The pastel revival spread well beyond France. The works of James McNeill Whistler were particularly influential. Both the Whistler pastels in this exhibition date from a year the artist spent in Venice. He responded to the city's glimmering light and crumbling facades with a series of diaphanous sketches in black Conte crayon, touched with intense dabs of pastel. He traveled around Venice in a rented gondola with his box of pastels, sometimes finishing the crayon sketch before adding color, and at other times alternating between the two. In nearly every case, he left broad expanses of bare brown paper. With typical modesty, Whistler wrote to his sister that he thought the pastels would prove irresistible to buyers, adding, "I assure you, the people, painter fellows here who have seen them, are quite startled at their brilliancy." The exhibition of Whistler's pastels after he returned to London was such an event that one of his admirers recorded each work of art in a thumbnail sketch. This is one of the ones in the exhibition, and it is number 15 here in the thumbnails. Whistler himself designed the frames and had the gallery specially decorated in yellow, green, green gold, and red brown. Some people were confused by the abbreviated sketches. In fact, a few visitors to the private viewing believed the pastels were a joke. Nonetheless, many others recognized their genius. The exhibition attracted quite a bit of attention, raising the visibility of the medium and establishing Whistler as one of its masters. Some American artists, including Julian Alden Weir, emulated Whistler's delicate style. Many other American pastelists of the period, however, favored a more painterly style that recalls the work of the early pastel painters, but with a modern twist. William Merritt Chase's study of flesh color and gold embodies this approach beautifully. The entire surface of the paper is covered with a layer of blended pastel. In the background, he blurred forms together into undefined patches of color, recalling his advice to his students. Be like a camera, and as you focus on one spot, the others lose in distinctness. Here, he's focused on the model's back, a masterpiece of subtle blending. Chase felt it was important to work quickly, as he said, so as not to lose the moment of inspiration. And pastel's immediacy was almost certainly part of the reason it played such an important role in his work. As the 20th century progressed, any remaining beliefs or conventions relating to pastel quickly dissipated. This is especially true of the range of subject matter. George Lux and Everett Shin both turned to pastel for unidealized urban scenes like these. Both Lux and Shin were members of the Eight, a group of American artists who reacted against the narrow tastes and exhibition policies of the National Academy of Design and advocated a broadening of the range of traditional subject matter. It's tempting to see their use of pastel, once reserved mainly for aristocratic portraits, as an act of rebellion. In fact, they were both familiar with the medium from earlier parts of their careers. Both got their starts as illustrators and used black and white pastel to create vivid, rapid sketches intended for reproduction in magazines and newspapers. When the artists later returned to pastel for more elaborate drawings like these, the works retained the spontaneity of the earlier illustrations. It's in this last room of the exhibition that we have the most sweeping view of pastel's versatility. Some 20th century artists have found that pastel's distinctive characteristics do not meet their needs. Matisse and Lichtenstein, for example, tried it for brief periods and then abandoned it, making their pastels quite rare. Others, such as Daniel Massad, devote most of their careers to working with it. The meticulous technique of his meditative still life reflects long years of experience with the medium. Women, of course, continue to use pastel, though its association with femininity has long ago fallen by the wayside. Etta Renouf clearly does not share her 18th century forerunner's concerns about the soiling of her fair hands. She spent much of her career exploring the textures and structures of her materials, whether that means pulling threads from the canvas of her paintings, or, as here, cutting rough incisions in her paper and rubbing the surface with pastel, which lodges in the cut fibers. Pastel's powdery texture is perfect for this purpose. Although her art has virtually nothing in common with the pastel paintings of the first room of the exhibition, Renouf, like all the other artists represented here, selected pastel for its distinctive properties, its rich color, and its matte velvety texture. And now I'm turning you over to Kim for a closer look at how artists used pastel.
Today, I will provide a glimpse into the production of the pastels in the exhibition, their preservation, and their restoration. An early drawing by the Venetian artist Jacopo Bassano from 1568 is drawn with naturally occurring chalks on blue paper made from rags dyed with indigo. Extracted from the earth, natural chalks are found in a range of reds, white, black, brown, yellow, and even green. Though all are called chalks, they differ in chemical composition. To make pastels, these same materials, as well as other colored pigments, are ground into powders and mixed with fillers, water, and a binder, typically a plant gum. The mixture is rolled into a dough, then sticks, and allowed to dry. By adding increasing amounts of white fillers, lighter tints of the base color can be produced, as seen on the right. Altering the amount and type of filler and binder influences pastel's working properties from soft and creamy to hard and grainy. In addition to describing color, artists use pastel's versatile properties to simulate the smoothness of skin, represent diverse textures, and evoke atmospheric effects. Unlike watercolors and oil paints that are mixed into different hues before application, pastels are rubbed and blended directly on the support. Marks can be left to stand alone or be rubbed into smooth transitions of color. In her self-portrait from circa 1900, Käthe Kollwitz drew with the side and tip of the pastel stick, allowing the marks to stand intact with little blending, except for the action of a pastel stick being drawn over an existing mark. Where she applied lighter pressure on the stick, pigment deposited only on high points of the textured paper and skipped over the valleys, allowing the paper's beige color to be visible. These flecks of beige added dappled light into an otherwise somber portrait. To blend or mix marks of pastel, artists use fingertips, brushes, stumps of rolled paper or leather, and rags. John Russell, in his 1794 portrait of Mary Wood, used a brush to blend the pastel. The direction of the brush strokes can be seen in this detail of the woman's dress. Notice the fine deposit of particles from where Russell lifted his brush from the paper's surface. He used a tool, perhaps even the end of his brush, or a hard white pastel to draw furrowed squiggles through the layers of soft powder. In this study of a woman dressing herself, Edgar Degas layered hatched lines of pastel, selectively blending areas probably using his fingertips. In a detail of the woman's hip and leg, you can see the strokes of peach, yellow-green, pink, tan, cool green, and orange-red. When mixed together along the outer part of the leg, they form a light brown. Too much physical mixing of such diverse colors, especially complementary or opposite ones, results in a loss of luminosity. Degas intuitively understood the amount of blending necessary to model the shape of the woman's hip without compromising the liveliness of the colors he used to interpret the tones of her flesh. When working with crumbly media, like pastel and natural chalks, the support, whether paper, parchment, or primed canvas, plays an important role in the development and appearance of the work of art. Pastel requires supports with a grainy texture, called tooth, to capture and hold the powdery media. Before the production of paper, specifically for drawing, artists sought out rough utilitarian papers, often in shades of blue, pale brown, and gray. In this oil painting from circa 1750 by Arthur Pond, Lady Astley sits in front of an easel drawing on blue paper. Likely, it was adhered overall to fabric and wrapped around a wooden strainer. A tray of pastels sits on her lap. Many 18th century portraits are on supports like that pictured in Pond's painting, including the one by Maurice Quentin de la Tour on the left and the Allegory of Painting by Rosalba Carriera on the right. Hints of the grayish-blue papers are faintly visible in areas where the pastel is less thickly applied. For instance, in the bluish veins on the back of the man's hand. Both Carriera and Latour wetted the ends of the pastel sticks to create marks of greater density and prominence, such as the flowers in the woman's hair and the strong white highlights on the brass tacks of the man's chair and in his blue kerchief. Unlike Carriera and Latour, who worked on easels, the itinerant artist James Sharples and his wife Ellen required easily portable small sheets of paper, as seen in these two portraits of Mr. and Mrs. John Bard. Containing wool fibers, the soft brownish-gray paper's original purpose was probably to add body to collars of jackets or hats, or possibly as padding for carpet. The Sharples preferred this type of paper because of its relative low cost, as well as its fibrous surface texture. Both James and Ellen used powdered colors, not sticks of pastel, which they kept in small glass bottles and applied by brushes. In this detail, taking in raking light, you can see the felt-like structure of the paper and how the pigment is embedded between the fibers as well as on the surface. Here, the pigment particles have been compacted from being pressed against glass in a frame for many years. Today, we ensure that there is adequate space inside frames to prevent pastels from being in contact with the glazing. Beginning in the 19th century, papermakers offered artists a broad range of colored papers and sheets developed specifically for pastel. Popular were variegated papers composed of multicolored fibers, as in this sketch of Venice by James McNeill Whistler. The paper contains red, blue, and coarse brown fibers in addition to cream and beige. The variegated paper contributes to the impression of flickering light bouncing off the water surface and onto the adjacent buildings. The paper's edges are extremely discolored from previous contact with acidic framing materials, in this case, probably wood. Some papers, specifically marketed for drawing with pastel, had coatings of pumice, textile fibers, and sawdust. The manufacturer would first apply adhesive to the paper. While the surface was tacky, gritty or fibrous materials would be dusted on top. William Merritt Chase drew his study of a woman, partially draped in a kimono in front of a Japanese screen, on a paper coated with pumice dyed a mauve color. The gritty pumice surface enabled Chase to build up dense layers of pastel on the woman's back. In contrast, Odilon Redon drew this bouquet of flowers on a paper coated with textile fibers called velour paper. In this detail, the velvet-like surface of the paper becomes more evident. Redon described the flowers with individual marks of pastels, sometimes wetting the stick in water to emphasize particular flower petals or parts of a leaf. Several works in the exhibition are on paper or canvas coated with a ground, such as this small portrait by the 18th century British artist Daniel Gardner. Light shown at an oblique angle reveals the diagonal brushstrokes of the coating Gardner applied to the paper. He developed the portrait with gouache, an opaque watercolor, pastel, and paint made from crushed pastel sticks. Pastel can be crumbled into powder and mixed with water and binder to make an opaque paint. Depending on the preparation, the paint can contain chunks of pastel. Like other British artists whose works are in the exhibition, Gardner articulated the face and hands with narrow black lines of graphite pencil. Instead of paper, Antoine Bergeon brushed a thick ground of gesso directly on canvas tacked to a stretcher, similar in structure to an oil painting. The smooth yet granular surface of gesso differs from paper's fibrous texture. For some parts of the image, the artist possibly dipped a rolled leather stump into pastel powder and then drew marks with the end of the stump. The technique is easier to recognize in this detail of a floral study in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The indistinct, soft character in the leaves and parts of the flowers suggests they were drawn using a stump loaded with pigment. To create the even brown shadow behind the birds, the artist may have dabbed a rag or piece of cotton wool into powdered pigment and then dusted the color onto the gessoed canvas. Bergeon's depiction of a hunting trophy is unusual in his body of work, which is dominated by floral paintings. Moreover, it is extremely rare in the history of pastel. Unlike Gardner and Bergeon, who prepared their supports with water-based paint or gesso, Edouard Manet purchased fabric commercially prepared with an off-white, oil-based ground. Unfortunately, Manet's works often exhibit losses of pastel, probably due in part to the slick, unreceptive surface of the oil ground. In this detail, the light spots in the black dress are where clumps of pastel have fallen off, exposing the ground below. At this point in time, there is not an acceptable solution for securing the pastel to the canvas. Pastel is frequently combined with other media. In Two Women, Degas laid out the composition with a few lines of charcoal before adding strokes of watercolor and pastel. To create the pattern wallpaper, he layered lightly drawn horizontal lines of green and orange pastel over vertical brushstrokes of Burgundy watercolor. The dashed lines of pastel appear powdery compared to the flowing strokes of watercolor. To the bodice of the woman's dress, Degas tossed crumbled pastel into liquid and quickly applied it as a watery mixture with a brush. When the wash dried, it deposited clumps of pastel in a lacy pattern, as seen in this detail taken under a microscope. Like his nude study you saw earlier, Degas juxtaposed strokes of vivid colors with muted tones and delicately drawn areas with those of great intensity. For example, after he sensitively outlined the woman's eyes, nose, and mouth with a dull brownish purple, he added bold marks of bright colors to her face and neck. In his symbolist depiction of St. George and the Dragon, Uri Longredon completed the composition in charcoal. Later, he added individual lines of color in hard pastel, seen more clearly in the detail on the right. Before adding pastel, Redon applied a resinous liquid or fixative to secure the friable charcoal to the paper. The fixative prevented the charcoal from sullying the pastel colors as he drew. It also enabled the artist to delicately incise highlights into the charcoal layer with a pointed tool or knife, exposing the lighter paper color below. Applying a fixative allows artists to build up colors on top of each other without disturbing the layers beneath. Fixatives, however, can cause pastel to darken or lose its desirable downy surface. In fact, most 18th century pastelists did not fix their works and instead framed them behind glass. Even though artists such as Degas and Redon used fixative between layers, they rarely applied it to the finished work, allowing the uppermost marks of pastel to retain their powdery freshness. In this study for a 7-foot sculpture of a mother and child, Charles Alston combined wide brushstrokes of black ink with dynamic marks in yellow and orange pastel. The full drawing is pictured at the left, in large details of the mother and child to the right. Alston may have used an airbrush or a spray paint to produce tones composed of fine dark dots, most evident in the detail of the mother's face. He drew the study on pieces of thin, inexpensive paper, secured across the center with masking tape. The torn and folded drawing was later mounted to a large secondary sheet, toned with black ink. At this point in his artistic career, Alston shifted between realism and abstractive figural themes inspired by African art. So what kind of problems do conservators encounter in pastels? The most obvious issue is the loss of pastel particles. This work by Henri Matisse presents an especially worrisome case. Matisse constructed this richly colored drawing using distinct marks of pastel on a paper coated with sawdust. As you can see at the top of the detail, the sawdust particles have deteriorated and darkened to a warm brown and are now easily dislodged from the paper. Conservators do not apply fixatives because they could alter the color and surface of the pastel. Instead, we limit movement of delicate works, such as the Matisse, and then only using flat carts equipped with pneumatic wheels that reduce shock and vibration. We take special precautions when installing pastels onto a wall. Sometimes extremely fragile works are displayed at a slanted angle to prevent possible loss of particles. Because the Matisse has not been seen by the public in many decades, we decided to hang it upright on the wall as the artist intended. Adelaide Labille-Guillard added the brilliant white stripes in the sitter's diaphanous scarf using a wetted pastel stick and paint made of crushed pastel. Unfortunately, this white is not securely attached to the paper and has suffered some minute losses. In this case, a conservator was able to help secure flaking pieces of pastel to the surface. While working under a microscope, a conservator locally applied a dilute adhesive using a fine brush to reattach the lifting and insecure clumps of pastel. A problem frequently found in older pastels is mold from being kept in damp environments. Fine filaments of mold, called hypha, cover the eyes of the sitter in this portrait by Jean-Baptiste Perrineau, which weakened the young man's gaze, as you can see in the detail at the top right. Some hypha could be removed using tweezers and a fine brush, although some were rooted further into the surface and had to remain. The detail below was taken after the mold was removed. A pastel, unprotected by a frame and glazing, becomes vulnerable to accidental scratching. Even the gentle touch of a man's tie or a woman's long hair can dislodge fluffy pastel. The detail on the right, in this portrait by Pietro Rotari, shows scuffs through the woman's sleeve. The image on the left was taken after conservation treatment had been completed. Silicone-tipped artist tools such as color shapers and fine pointed brushes, including those composed of a single hair, were used to move pastel particles back into place and add new pigment to disguise the scratches. The Rotari also suffered water damage, as seen along the right edge in the detail. Liquids compress pastel particles, often altering the color. To lessen the darkening effect of the water damage, particles were gently fluffed up using the same tools as mentioned earlier. The boundary between the damaged and undamaged areas required the addition of a little pigment to make the transition less obvious. So I leave you today with one of my favorite works in the exhibition, Untitled by Jasper Johns, based on an oil and caustic and collage painting from 1972. Hatched marks of green, purple, and orange pastel at left represent a motif he frequently used in works throughout the 1970s and 80s. In the center, the pattern of red, white, and black flagstones relates to a wall Johns once saw in Harlem. The image on the right simulates the wooden slats and wax casts of body parts in the 1972 painting. John's interest in the intrinsic and tactile qualities of his materials pervades all of his work, even in his selection of paper. For this pastel, he chose a beautiful sheet of gray Japanese paper made of mulberry or kozo fibers, an unusual support for pastel. He built up marks, applying fixative between the layers to prevent unwanted blending of colors, leaving the gray color to show through, unifying the entire picture. Like many works in the exhibition, the pastel's sensuous surface is a treat for the eye. I hope you all enjoy the exhibition. Thank you for coming today.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.